This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark and Noelle Lim. 6 a.m. Thursday, the 8th of October, or as we like to call it here on The Morning Run, Friday Junior.
Yes, very good, Thursday.
What are your plans for your Friday Junior this morning?
Well, first of all, we will interview the finance minister of
exciting
Malaysia.
Exciting times.
Yes, that's right, at 8.05 a.m.
All right, that's happening, yes, 8.05 a.m. Dato' Sri Tengku Zafrul Tengku Aziz is coming on the breakfast grill. So it's a live conversation, but of course remotely, because I do believe he's under home quarantine, right? After I think a lot of the cabinet ministers feared they were exposed when a minister attended a meeting who later tested positive for COVID-19.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so I think he tweeted that as well, that he's under home quarantine and he has been tested negative for COVID.
All right, but before that, we do have a number of other interesting talk discussions lined up for you. So, of course, later on at about 6.45, we're looking at what's on the front pages of our newspapers and portals. Then at 6.30, we're turning our attention overseas for some international news. At 6.15, what do we have, Noelle?
Well, it seems we're going to be talking a lot about politics. So this question here, should publications endorse political candidates?
All right, and if you want to weigh in on those conversations, you can WhatsApp us, 01 8 7 8 9 8 8 9 9, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, in this increasingly polarized world, would you have a relationship with someone with different political beliefs? We'll be discussing that in just a few minutes. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Clash with Revolution Rock, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn and Noelle. So, you know, I think especially politics in recent times has become quite polarizing, particularly if you're a resident of the United States. And it appears that in the long list of daily areas that politics is starting to seep into, dating is also becoming one of them. Because Time.com is looking at some research that was put out by Match, which is the biggest of what they describe here, the big cheese of matchmaker websites. And it talks about what the opinions of singletons in America. And one of the interesting developments is that some of the research has suggested that, say, voting for President Trump would be a deal breaker for more than 70% of Democratic voters. And this is already also research from Pew. And whereas conversely, having voted for Hillary Clinton in the previous election would turn off nearly half of Republicans. So I guess this gives rise to the question of, would you date someone from across the aisle politically? You know, what do you think about this, Noelle?
Well, I find this really interesting, right? In the past, we used to say polite conversation, try to leave politics out, especially if you're talking to someone that you're not familiar with. But I suppose when you go out on a date and you get to know that person, and probably that question nowadays will come up, who do you support? And it looks like the Democrat voters do feel very strongly about this, right? Because additional statistics here show that fewer than half of Democrats would spurn a Republican for his party affiliation alone, but only fewer than a quarter of Republicans felt the same way about Democrats. So it seems like the Democrats are, you know, feeling really angst about this. What I do know from my American friends, though, really, I think since maybe Trump or maybe even just before that as well, politics has really increasingly polarized American society. People are getting, you know, having very strong views of which president they should support. And I think it just doesn't help when you have quite a president, who is quite polarizing. And if I may say, someone like President Trump.
Yeah, so one wonders how this filters down into daily life as well, right? Because for the most part, we, especially as a function of where we live and work, political ideologies tend to be somewhat similar. Because they're typically defined as, you know, in the US, you know, you could say New York is a blue state, for example. Others are a red state. But when it comes to meeting new people, and obviously the dating pool is where you most frequently meet new people and have to make small talk and get to know people, how would you react when someone has markedly different political ideologies from you? Because I find that a lot of the time when we're talking with our friends, you know, who have similar political ideologies, it's very easy to almost create a caricature of people who don't believe the same. Whereas when you're confronted with someone who actually has justifications for why they believe that way, it can be an entirely different conversation. So how does that translate into being able to, does that translate to being able to date someone with a different political affiliation for you?
There is a risk, right? You know, we can slip into that echo chamber. So I have to say, it really depends on that reason for that political belief and what exactly is that belief, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people who believe in a particular party, but they may not support all leaders in that party. They may favour only certain leaders. And likewise, they may also like leaders from the other side. So I think it really depends on the reason and how balanced that arguments are.
Yeah, I think for me it would too. Do you have any deal breakers? I'm curious, because I do. And some of my deal breakers include things like, so, you know, if we take an example of the conversations in the US, the pro-life versus pro-choice discussion, I'm very heavily pro-choice because I, you know, so if I was to be looking at someone and their opinions infringe upon my own agency, then there's going to be a little bit of a problem here if things go any further.
Yeah, so I think two things for me, agency, like if I have to now cover up my head and go anywhere, yeah, that might be an issue for me because that's really infringing on my personal rights, right? My personal space. So that's one.
It's important to you.
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. And secondly, it would be... maybe not so much what they believe in, but what they do. So any party that's corrupt, that is a problem for me. That's almost like a deal breaker for me.
Mm-hmm.
But understandably, not everyone in a party is corrupt. There are some honest people trying to do an honest job every day. But you know, if it all starts from the top, right, it's very hard to support a party that is known to be corrupt.
Yeah, but I think it is interesting having conversations sometimes when it comes to political parties, and obviously we've got a lot of them here in Malaysia. I have close family members who are MCA, for example, and growing up, you know, politically, I did not feel that MCA had done a good job, you know. So the conversations that have been had, respectful, curious conversations about why don't you really support MCA or why are you still supporting MCA, those conversations actually, I think, helped both sides to grow. And I understand where they're coming from because a lot these family members of mine, it's a family tradition almost for them to be affiliated with the party, and they have strong beliefs and they have strong reform wishes for that party that they are affiliated with. They don't necessarily agree with what the leaders are saying, but because of particularly also Asian cultures, right? You know, when someone at the top says something, those who are lower down on the hierarchy don't necessarily come out to the public to disagree vocally. They may disagree internally, which, you know, and just kind of keep all your, you know, don't air your dirty laundry sort of feelings, right?
Yeah, so I think MCA is an interesting case study because I think in the early years, there were many people who support MCA. They believe in the cause, you know, this whole thing about independence, working together with different races. I think there was that, you know, the whole sentiment. But then a party changes, right? Because a party consists of people. People change, leaders change, mm-hmm. It evolves, right? And it evolves with the times on survival and all that. So, but I think you know, all said and done by MCA, for example, I think they've actually done a lot for the Chinese community. I think helping Chinese schools, making sure Chinese students, very deserving students, get scholarships. They almost actually function quite well as an NGO.
Yes, perhaps that. And I think that is one of the directions that they were looking at heading into, particularly after MCA lost a number of its seats in GE14, almost all of them, in fact, save one. So I guess, you know, these political parties are now having to redefine themselves in this new political landscape. So I guess we'll have to watch and see how it goes. But let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Tell us, would you have a relationship with someone who has different political affiliations from you? We're interested to know what you think. But right now, some messages, and then up next, whether or not publications should endorse a particular candidate in an election. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark and Noelle Lim. So that was Rules by Hoops, and you're listening to The Morning Run. So we're looking this morning at the subject of, once again, politics and elections, because over in the US, as we discussed just now, events leading up until the November 3rd election have been rather polarizing. And you know, Americans tend to fall very hard on either side of the divide, whether they're pro-Trump or pro-Biden. And the New York Times has come out with an article. This is an opinion in the opinion section of their website with the headline, Elect Joe Biden, America. So the subline is here is, for the former vice president is the leader our nation needs now. And this has raised the question of whether or not publications should be coming out in open support of one candidate or another in an election. To be fair, the New York Times does make the distinction that this is an article by the editorial board, so consisting of opinion journalists. So this is separate from the newsroom. But optically, it looks like the New York Times is coming out, is kind of supporting Joe Biden, right?
Yes, obviously somebody endorsed that article, right? Approved for the article to be fit, to be placed online or on their hard copy. So I think to me, it's a slippery slope. One can never be certain of a candidate, right? A candidate has their failings and so forth. But maybe, perhaps, desperate times do call for desperate measures, and you actually have to come out really strongly as a media company or as journalists to kind of like, you know, try to sway people's opinions to, you know, to try to influence people's views, right? Especially if you have very strong views of a particular candidate and you really feel strongly that he is the best person for the job. So it is a slippery slope, I feel. But understandably, in the US, it's a very fertile environment, right? It's very rich. The media the media industry is really quite alive there. Like, you know, people are very free in expressing their opinions. I find that somewhat in Malaysia, maybe we could be a bit more conservative. Endorsing candidates is a slippery slope. However, I think supporting parties, that I'm not sure, supporting political parties or supporting their causes or their philosophy, that one to me, I think is an open question.
Yeah, for me, it's not just supporting, coming out in support of particular parties, it's also receiving support from political groups, because then, you know, that calls into question your whole editorial slant, right, when you're talking about a news organization. But then when it comes to things like this, you know, this is an opinion by the collective editors of the New York Times. Should it be taken as, does it change your view of the New York Times as a reporting institution that they have come out with this article?
It doesn't actually. It doesn't, because I think the New York Times just for me has already have a long tradition, whether through their journalist opinions or even through the way they write their news, they have already have this long tradition. I say tradition, but although it's like 5 years plus of being very critical of Trump. So to me, this additional piece just adds on to that pile. It doesn't sway my opinion in any way about the New York Times. If anything, it probably just reinforces, of course we will expect the New York Times to write this, whether it's by their journalists or by themselves.
Yeah, so I guess for me, that's where it gets a little bit sticky, right? Because what Donald Trump has said many times of the New York Times, of CNN, of CNBC, is that, oh, they're, you know, left-wing liberal news organizations, they proponents of fake news and so on. But I always feel that news organizations, whether or not it's the opinion section or the reporting section, you should strive for some form of objectivity. Right, and so if you're going to criticize equally, but if you're going to praise equally, and do so with the facts at hand. So I had a glance through this article, and yes, this is based off, they put the caveat here that this is based off of expertise, research, debate, and certain long-standing values, it doesn't really, it admittedly doesn't sit well with me, because I do agree that this is a slippery slope. But then at the on the other side of the discussion is that freedom of expression, because you know, just because you are part of a news organization, does that mean you are not able to express your own political views?
Yeah, so I am starting to find that it's much better to actually talk to people rather than actually just read the news. Like, so I spoke to a friend, an American friend, and I asked him, why do you support the Republican Party? So he votes for the Republican Party. So he voted for McCain, and I think he voted for Trump as well. And so he said, oh, pay less taxes and pay less for healthcare. because he falls into that bracket where he will have to pay quite a fair bit for healthcare to ensure, like, you know, so Obamacare, right, is to, you know, mm-hmm. is to make sure that everyone receives care. So there will be a groups of people that will actually have to pay much more for healthcare. So to him, it was really bread and butter. And we are talking about someone who's middle class, highly educated, went to some of the best schools. And they feel, well, it's just less taxes and, you know, this thing about healthcare. So it's all about, you know, what hits the pocket.
Yeah, I think it's true. It's true, you know, as we saw in the Sabah state elections as well, that really for a lot of voters, what it affects their voting decision most is who they believe is going to have the most impact on their finances, on their standard of living. And, you know, a lot of the ideological debates tend to fly over their heads. You know, it's like, why does it matter, you know, what is being said when I don't have enough money to put food on the table? But I guess in a situation like this, your publication or your organization is already facing allegations of being biased and being unfair. This just kind of, it's like putting another nail in that coffin, you know? So you are going to, for me, it feels like you are going to lose those readers who are sitting on the fence because, you know, they may not like that you seemingly have come out in strong support of one candidate over the other.
And these tend to be that silent majority, right? They just silently disappear from reading your publication.
Yeah, it's a fine line to draw, and let us know where you fall on it. Should publications endorse political candidates? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news bulletin coming up for you, but first a song by the Ramones. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor by Baby Charles, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn and Noel. Now, we're turning our attention overseas now. Particularly, we've been having lots of discussions circling around the US in the past half hour, and there is news out of the US that COVID-19 is continuing to spread through the White House. So a White House aide, White House advisor Stephen Miller, as well as a top military official have reportedly been infected with COVID-19. Several military leaders are also now under quarantine after a Coast Guard official tested positive for the virus. And this is, of course, very shortly after President Trump himself was tested positive for the virus and shortly after released into the public once again. So it's quite an interesting time in the US.
Yes, just looking at the number of people that have been infected, those around Donald Trump, I think it's something like 17 people, including his wife. I'm not suggesting that he infected them, but, you know, people around him. So 17 people. And what Joe Biden has responded, he said that, well, Mr. Trump should not debate him if he's still infected. So I think they are scheduled to meet on 15 October in Miami. So Biden says he will be guided by medical experts on whether that debate should still proceed.
Yes, and they don't have a lot of time to decide. It's only 1 week away. But when it comes to discussing these, you know, virus fears, it appears that when we come closer to home in Thailand, the majority of Thais don't agree with government's plans to reopen their borders to foreign tourists. So this is a survey that was conducted by the Bangkok-based National Institute of Development Administration that showed about 57% of participants were concerned that the reopening would increase the risk of COVID infections and disagreed with the plan. They also found that 62% weren't confident that the government can avoid the reemergence of the virus once their countries reopened to holidaymakers.
Yeah, so I think really depends who they survey, right? I mean, if they are surveying people who really, really depend on the tourist trade, mm-hmm. You might get a very different answer. And but if you're surveying somebody who has a job, living in a comfortable environment, they might, of course, say keep the country closed. Like if you ask me, I'll say, yeah, keep the borders closed, right? So, but if I talk to my friends in airlines, he is saying that they need to have a balance. We need to start thinking about seriously opening our borders to Singapore, for example, not just for business travelers, but also for everyone else. Because Singapore, for example, very few cases now, mm-hmm. right? Of course, whether Singaporeans want to come here is another story.
Yeah. So I think it also
It really does depend on the position these countries as a whole are in as well, right? So Singapore is obviously suffering quite a lot because of the fact that its economy is so open. And Thailand as well is highly dependent on the tourist trade. And with international borders all shut and international air travel not expected to recover until 2024, it doesn't look like there's much of a silver lining for Thailand. And you add to that the complications of will they see imported cases once they open their borders? The risk is definitely high. But so it's tough for governments around the world to try and strike this balance of trying to salvage what dregs of their economy they can versus trying to avoid another public health crisis.
So just looking at the numbers, for example, I think in Thailand last year, they had a record 40 million foreign tourists. So we are saying 40 million people now cannot come in, and 1.9 trillion baht. That's a lot of money for them. So that's how it is for Thailand. But, you know, I'm quite interested in this other story, Mizuho Financial Group. They plan to allow staff to work 3 or 4 days a week on reduced pay as the Japanese bank is obviously assessing what post-pandemic working life will be. And really what interests me about this is underemployment, right? And we've been speaking about this the last few days. You have a job, but you're not working the full hours, and therefore you're not going to be earning the kind of pay that you used to enjoy or commensurates with your skill set.
Yeah, there was another article that I spotted recently in the BBC Work Life talking about the permanent problem of pay when it comes to remote work, because in a lot of places, there is still the perception that, okay, you know, if you're working at home, it means you're kind of, it's working light, right? It's not actually it's not the same as you being in the office. And so therefore, should you be compensated the same amount as if you were fully present in the office environment? Figuring out what this post-pandemic work life is going to look like is, I think, on the cards of every business. Right now, most of them are still in business, some kind of business contingency, I think, especially here in Malaysia. I think some have gone back into longer-term working from home plans. But at the end of the day, you know, people are still going to come into the office, but probably not at the same levels as they were before. So what is that, how is that going to affect salaries, and how is that going to affect ultimately job satisfaction and social mobility for the wider public?
Well, I think some people will try to make the most out of this situation, and what they will do is, okay, so I maybe only work 3 days for Mizuho, and the other 2 days I might pursue something I really want to do, like maybe go enroll myself into university doing a part-time course. Now I would actually have more days to study, prepare for the exam, or I take up another job, a part-time job.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps.
Or a business.
Perhaps. So that's going to remain to be seen. We are taking a look at what's happening on the front pages of our own newspapers and portals next. But after these messages, be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Bad Reputation by Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn and Noel. Thank you very much for your messages this morning. We've had a couple of tweets and WhatsApps in. Ro says, not sure about opposing political views, but I once dated an Arsenal fan, Ro being a supporter of their arch rival, the Spurs. To be fair, didn't know before they dated, so do your due diligence. Opposing views can be good and enlightening, but according to Ro, Spurs will always rule North London. So he's also said, hear that, Roshan, and Roshan's unfortunately not in studio with us this morning to defend Arsenal's honour. we'll definitely pass your message on. On Twitter, Ahmad Supian has also said, I'm married to one with different political beliefs. It doesn't matter. What matters is your relationship on daily livelihood. And I guess this does raise the idea that your relationship is what you make of it, right? Sometimes people, you don't have to get everything you need all at once from one person. Sometimes you have a partner because the two of you work well together on one thing, but not necessarily on another thing. And for that other thing, you that's what you have friends for, perhaps, for example.
Yes, yeah, I think agreeing to disagree. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to agree on everything, right, including how you're going to manage your money, although that should be agreed before you get married. And also how you want to raise your children, like, you know, do you think they should go to local university, foreign university? Two parents are likely to have different views.
Absolutely. So thank you for your messages. We are now taking a look at the newspapers as well as some of the portals. I have the Star in front of me this morning, and their headline here is Turning the Tide, accompanied by a picture of someone getting a COVID-19 swab test. So I think there was news yesterday that caused a bit of a kerfuffle that four red zones have been placed under a conditional movement control order, those red zones being Sandakan, Papar and Tuaran in Sabah, as well as Klang in Selangor. And of course, Klang is a very large area. So there have been a lot of questions raised over where exactly in Klang is the problem, and whether all of these areas will be under CMCO. And if so, I think panic buying has already started from what I hear from friends in Klang.
Yes, I have to say, when I first got the news on WhatsApp, my immediate reaction was, oh no, no Pak Kut Teh. Although the last time I've been to Klang for Pak Kut Teh was like ages, right? So anyway, that's my association with Klang. And well, speaking about CMCO, what does it really mean, right, for the folks at Klang? So only two people from one household are allowed to go out to buy essentials. You know, this seems like very long time ago, where only two people could go out or one person could go out, and all non-essential services are not allowed to operate. So I think if you want to leave the area, you have to show a letter if you are involved in some essential service. So speaking about some areas that are affected, I think NSD here has a few areas listed. The Tembok cluster has 139 new cases. Bah Sintok has 14. Jalan Meru has 4. Laut has 2. Benteng PK has 2. Selassie has 2. Bah Tanjung has 1. And Embon has 1. So, I guess it pays to be safe.
Absolutely. And I've also got Utusan Malaysia in front of me. And their headline here is Pindah Banduan Segera. So this is on the back of the news that our prisons have become a breeding ground for COVID-19. So there have been a lot of conversations on what's to be done, whether I think the stopgap measure has been to release certain prisoners on license, I think is the term that has been used. And we're going to be discussing this a little later on as well with Gerald Joseph of Suhaka, to talk about what kind of measures are actually possible to mitigate the spread of the virus in the prisons, because we have had this overcrowding problem for several years now and it hasn't yet been resolved, and now it's coming back to bite them, unfortunately.
Yeah, so COVID-19 has a way of sorting out life, right? So if you recall, the Immigration Depot also had this issue, overcrowding, and so Immigration Department had to work with the MOH on new SOPs in order to ensure inmates have sufficient space, and so likewise changes to be made in prisons. And moving on to this other story, Malaysian Reserve has on the front page, educators one more say in school closures amid COVID-19 spike. So school stakeholders and associations, they are feeling being left out in the dark on the next course of action when the coronavirus is detected in certain areas. So I think this really calls for some autonomy to be given to schools on how to respond quickly.
Yeah, so we have had this conversation as well with Dr. Sharifah Munira Alatas of UKM just a couple of days ago, talking about the public higher education and whether or not, you know, it has been proactive enough in coming up with SOPs, why at the MOHE didn't perhaps come out earlier with guidelines. So this is an ongoing conversation. And if I look at the Malay Mail as well in front of me, though, their lead story here, posted an hour ago, is as COVID-19 cases rise among Sabah detainees, Indonesian group reveals atrocious conditions its deported workers go through. And I think, you know, there's also another article, a rights group urging Putrajaya and Jakarta for some kind of long-term solution to protect Indonesian workers in Malaysia, because we know that physical distancing and wearing a mask is one of the best ways to flatten the curve of this virus. But what do you do when you're living in a small room with 10 other people where physical distancing is not very possible? Access to running water is limited, and you can't afford to buy masks. What do you do then? These workers are they are probably afraid. They probably don't have much in the way of recourse. So something does definitely need to be done, if only so we as well can avoid another outbreak in these camps.
And just very quickly, another story here, Channel News Asia. State fund Khazana to stop funding Malaysia Airlines if less leasing companies, the talks with them fail. So this sounds quite dramatic. So that was the plan A, to try to, get something, make some headway with leasing companies. But if plan A fails, plan B would be to direct resources to Firefly instead. And Firefly to operate some planes, domestic flights, more flights under the Malaysia Airlines banner, so to speak.
Interesting. All right. So that's going to be something that we will keep an eye on. But right now we are heading into the 7 o'clock news bulletin. And after that, we're bringing you more business news and analysis. But first, coming up next, Gonna Get My Baby Back by Doris Troy, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.